Before we get into today's podcast, I wanted to let you know about a special ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Five Ways to Connect with God, Ancient Practices for Modern Times. It's safe to say that in today's fast-paced culture, we're all seeking more rest and less chaos. Only then can we find true connection with our Creator. Five Ways to Connect to God offers five unique spiritual principles to Christians who may be feeling dry when it comes to their prayer life or spiritual fervor. These include practices such as choosing a word for the year, the power of one-phrase prayers, and the importance of cultivating thankfulness. Some of these principles are hundreds of years old, yet they offer a fresh way to connect us with the living God. Download your copy of Five Ways to Connect to God by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, John.
Hi, we're talking about a difficult, challenging issue again.
That's unlike us. Today's topic is something that you'll obviously be very familiar with, I hope, as a paediatrician, is prenatal screening. But before we dig into the kind of nitty-gritty of this topic, I think it's worth flagging up that this is obviously a deeply sensitive and personal topic for many people, including some of those who will be listening.
Yes, I mean, what we're going to be talking about are the terrible dilemmas that are confronted when a diagnosis of a fetal abnormality is made before birth, and it's perfectly possible that some people listening to this have been personally affected by this issue. You may yourself have faced this challenge in a pregnancy. You may have a disabling genetic condition, and so I think it's really important that whenever we talk about these issues that we recognise there's real pain here, and our first duty is to try to understand the struggles that people have and the difficulties that technology causes as we try to live lives that are faithful to the way we're made.
Yeah, absolutely right. I guess it's another example, as you often say, about our overarching theme in this podcast, about how technology often unintentionally is changing the experience of what it means to be human. In this sense, it's irreversibly changed the experience of what it means to be pregnant.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a very interesting theme. And certainly, you know, if you were to go back before the 60s and 70s, which is really when the very earliest ultrasound and screening tests became available in pregnancy, before that point, really there was nothing that was known about the baby in the womb. And the woman, you know, the mother had always the possibility of having an abortion. Abortion's been around since the dawn of history and has always been well recognised, whether it was legal or illegal. But apart from the option of abortion, there was nothing else really to do during a pregnancy apart from try and keep healthy and look forward with anticipation to meeting your new baby when they eventually arrived.
And so, as you say, abortion is not a new idea. There's evidence of it kind of as far back as we have historical evidence. But previously, it was all based around the desire for the child or lack thereof. And people only really ever had abortions because they didn't want, for various reasons, to be pregnant. So I suppose what the last 60 years has done is it's opened up the ability for us to look inside the womb and find out that the child is not how we imagined. It is carrying some sort of disability. And then people are starting to have abortions based not because they didn't want a child, they might definitely want a child, but because they didn't want that kind of child.
Yes, and ultrasound, I've often thought that ultrasound is an astonishing ability to peer into what was previously completely unknown. You know, think about Psalm 139, where the idea is that I'm being knit together, you knit me together in my mother's womb. But the idea is within the depths of the earth that was completely hidden It was the secret chamber in which God was at work. But now with high-resolution ultrasound, we get this extraordinary picture into the womb. And I can still remember the impact of seeing my children, including you, Tim, the first time, that first scan, and seeing this little being moving around. And I remember I had tears in my eyes, and this happened in our hospital at UCH, where the pregnancy was being supervised. And I remember going back down to my colleagues with this, you know, floating on air, and saying, "I've just seen my baby on the scan." And the general sort of reaction was, big deal, you know, scans were 10 a penny. We all looked at scans all day, every day. What was so different? So it has given this amazing vision into the womb. But unfortunately, along with that insight comes all kinds of ethical challenges and difficulties.
So I suppose to start off with, we should be kind of clear about what we're talking about and what the options, what technology is used to screen children before they're born. So people obviously are very familiar, at least here in the NHS in the UK, you typically are offered an ultrasound scan at 12 weeks and at 20 weeks. What are they looking for in particular?
Yeah, so the first ultrasound scan is really just to confirm that the pregnancy is viable, and that, for instance, that it's not an ectopic pregnancy or something like that, and also whether or not there are twins or triplets even. So and the dating of the pregnancy, this is the fundamental information. But it's not until the 20-week scan, when the baby is much more developed, that it's possible then to detect a whole range of rare conditions, including spina bifida or anencephaly when the brain doesn't develop possibly properly, other abnormalities of the abdomen, congenital heart disease, problems with the kidneys. A very long list of possible abnormalities can be picked up by ultrasound these days.
And what other tests might mothers be offered as routine as alongside ultrasound?
So in the NHS, and there is this program called the NHS Fetal Anomaly Screening Program, which is rolled out across the NHS and which all hospitals and midwives have to comply with. Women are offered blood tests called a combined test or a quadruple test. And these are basically intended particularly to identify chromosomal problems, particularly Down syndrome or rarer syndromes called Edwards syndrome and Patau syndrome.
And so somehow they're able to, even though it's the mother's blood, not the child's blood, they're able to figure out, look into the chromosomes and look into the genetic code of the fetus.
Well, what was discovered, first of all, was that there were elevated levels of various hormones in the mother's bloodstream, which correlated with an increased risk of the fetus having Down syndrome or one of these other rare chromosomal abnormalities. So what these tests do, by measuring a number of different markers within the mother's blood, you end up with a risk score of, say, 1 in 83 or 1 in 207 or 1 in 2050. A very precise statistical risk score that you have, that your fetus has one of these rare chromosomal problems.
And when mothers are told the results of that, those tests, what kind of information is offered? Is it just a simple kind of readout, you have X risk of this condition, or is there more?
It's basically that, a statistical risk. And then what happens in the NHS is, if your risk is deemed as being more than 1 in 150, greater than 1 in 150, you're then offered a diagnostic test. So if it's less than 1 in 150, so say, you know, the mother is told, well, your risk of Down syndrome is 1 in 189, the mother may well be told, but we don't routinely do anything else, and we advise you really just to ignore that. But if it's the risk is greater than 150, say 1 in 86 or 1 in 37, then the mother will be offered a diagnostic invasive test, and that's something called amniocentesis or chorionic villus sampling, when a needle is inserted into the womb and the uterus, and either fluid around the baby or else a section of the placenta, a small fragment of the placenta, is removed and analysed.
And of course, these carry separate from what they're trying to do, which is to confirm or kind of deny the chance of the fetal kind of abnormality, but they separately also, because they are invasive, carry a small but not impossible chance of prompting a miscarriage.
Yes, and this is one of the tragic and very difficult, painful dilemmas that mothers are confronted with. And that is the risk of miscarriage, and therefore of the unborn baby dying, is somewhere between 1 in 200, 1 in 100, or it seems to vary from centre to centre and depending on the precise skill of the operator and so on, but it's of that order. And therefore, there is a small but significant chance that a baby who in fact is completely healthy might die simply as a result of this diagnostic test, which of course is a terrible tragedy, and parents are warned of that risk when they are considering whether or not to go on for this formal diagnostic test.
So if I've heard you right, there might be some instances where, so you're offered the diagnostic invasive test if your chances is greater than 1 in 150, let's say your chance is 1 in 149, you then go on to take an invasive test which might have a 1 in 100, i.e. an even more greater possibility of killing your child effectively. So as I've understood that right, you might actually do this test when the odds of the original kind of condition being present are less than the odds of causing a miscarriage.
Well, they're certainly of the same kind of order. The risk of the baby having the condition and the risk of a miscarriage happening are of the same kind of order. And that it is a terrible tragedy, because it means effectively that a fetus that's completely normal might die as a result of the test, just because there's no way to get rid of this risk. And because of this tragedy, there's been a lot of development to try to develop a way of detecting Down syndrome and these other chromosomal abnormalities without causing a risk to the fetus. And so what has been developed is what is now called non-invasive prenatal testing, which involves, again, taking a sample from the mother's blood, so there's nothing invasive as far as the fetus is concerned, but it is possible to isolate a small number of cells from the fetus, the unborn baby, that are circulating in the mother's bloodstream, and the DNA is isolated is analysed, and it's then possible to detect chromosomal abnormalities in the fetus just from a blood test from the mother.
So the NIPT, as far as I understand, that is just starting to be rolled out in the NHS. It's not standard or routine or available in every centre, but it is starting to become available, and that carries no risk to the baby, unlike these other. But does it have the same diagnostic capacity? You know, is it as certain as doing an amniocentesis?
Well, that's the problem. It isn't. It's probably 98%, 99% accurate, but it isn't 100% accurate. So we're again in this difficult probabilistic condition, and therefore it's possible that you have what's called a false positive. In other words, this test has flagged up that the fetus has some abnormality of the chromosomes, which in fact is not accurate. And therefore, the general advice from doctors working in this field is that an abortion should not be carried out until the formal diagnostic test has been carried out, until amniocentesis has been carried out. But the situation is now complicated, because although the NIPT is only being made available in certain areas in the NHS, it's now possible to buy it commercially online over the internet.
Yes, you just sent me before we started recording a link to a website, to a company which was based in the UK, which will sell you a range of different NIPT tests straight to your door, starting at just £299. And they, on the website, they have a whole series of tests going all the way up to £999 for the most comprehensive one. And these, presumably, you just ship to the door. You do a blood sample, post it back to them. They analyze in their lab, and then they tell you if your child has got Down syndrome or Edwards syndrome or microdeletion 22q11.2, whatever that means.
Yes, and most of the tests, they will simply send you the results and say, well, you know, that's what the result shows. If you pay extra, in this particular case, you can have a complimentary 15-minute telephone consultation with a genetic counsellor in the event of a high-risk result. And that, of course, raises the whole issue about genetic counselling. And you can imagine that a mother who discovers that she has some incredibly rare thing called a chromosomal aneuploidy and microdeletion that she didn't even know what those words meant is now very much dependent on really careful, wise, informed counselling about what the significance of this might be for her baby.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And I suppose something we probably should have mentioned earlier is that all of this testing, and it continues to advance year by year with what is possible, what is available, there is no ability to treat any of these conditions, these rare chromosomal abnormalities in the womb. So the information is simply information, and the only options are, great, now I know my child has Down syndrome, and I either choose to do nothing and carry on, but with this knowledge, or I choose to have an abortion. There's no other use that information can be put to.
That's true for these major genetic anomalies. It isn't true for the other conditions we talked about, things like congenital heart disease or other structural abnormalities, which can be treated, and some it's even possible, increasingly now possible, for interventions to be happened in the unborn baby to have some kind of fetal treatment before the baby's born. So there are a number of conditions like that. But when we're talking about these genetic conditions, then no, there is no available treatment.
And I suppose that's where we get into some of the tricky ethical questions and dilemmas, because we're, you know, it's easy to say on the surface, well, giving, you know, soon-to-be parents more information, how could that be a bad thing? But actually, the kind of increasing options for screening, including kind of going private and buying these test kits over the internet, as you mentioned, genetic counselling, it actually doesn't, providing information then just leads to further questions about what do I do with this information?
Yes, it does. It raises all kinds of complex ethical dilemmas, which we're still sort of trying to get our heads around and struggle with the implications. But one thing just to mention is that the NIPT test also provides the gender of the baby, whether it's male or female. And one of the concerns is that there are many cultures across the world where there's a very strong social pressure to have a male child. A male child is highly desirable. And therefore, it's possible to use this test, which can be done from about 10 weeks gestation, to find out whether or not the fetus is a boy or a girl. And if the fetus is in the gender that isn't desired, you can then go and have an abortion. You don't have to tell the abortion clinic why you're having an abortion. You could just say that for whatever reason this is unwanted, the baby's unwanted. And this way, this technology is allowing fetal sex selection.
And I know it's certainly the case in some parts of the world that this is happening often enough that there is now a marked difference in the birth rates for boys and girls, which is, you know, in nature almost exactly 50-50. And yet there are certain places where it's now seen in the kind of statistics of who is being born each year that there is a marked increase in boys being born, which can only be explained by socially driven sex selection abortions.
That's right. So in the NHS, in the screening process, parents are not routinely told the sex of the baby unless there is for a medical reason. There are rare conditions which are only expressed in one particular gender, male or female, and in those reasons there may be a medical reason to disclose the result, but otherwise, for social reasons, the NHS policy is not to reveal the sex because of the risk of sex selection abortion.
So zooming out a little bit, so that's the kind of overview of what kind of prenatal screening is routinely available, at least in one kind of developed Western nation here in the UK. Why does this all mean? Why are we talking about this? Why does this matter? Surely it's just a standard onward march of technology and medicine. It gets better each year. We get more information. Was there any kind of thinking, or have NHS been rolling out these new screening tests just as they become available?
Yeah, well, the fascinating thing is that there's never really been any very serious democratic debate about these screening tests for disabilities, including the screening test for Down syndrome. It was introduced by doctors simply because it seemed obvious that this was a good thing to do, that it was seen as a way of reducing the, quote, burden of disability in the community, and that but just by giving parents options of whether or not they wish to have an abortion was basically assumed to be a good thing without any real careful ethical discussion. And the NHS has really just adopted this really very sophisticated fetal anomaly screening program without any detailed democratic discussion as to whether this is something which we as a country believe is right. And it is interesting how it leads to a very extraordinary doublethink in our society, whereas there's an increasing tendency, quite rightly and appropriately, to respect the lives of people with disabilities in our community and to emphasise the importance of disability rights. There's a great deal of emphasis about the Paralympics and athletes and other people, and a celebration of people with disabilities, and they increasingly appear in films and television programs and online and so on. And yet at the same time, as a society, we seem to be investing in order to try to detect disabling conditions before birth so that parents have the option of having an abortion.
Indeed, I read when the debate around the kind of, or when the NIPT was first being kind of discussed and introduced in the UK, the stats I think are in the order of that currently approximately 90% of children who are detected as having Down syndrome are aborted before birth. And the expectation was that when the NIPT comes in, because it is can be done without invasive, and so it carries less risk, that those numbers will increase because more mothers will become aware that their child has Down syndrome. And in other countries, I think the common example was pointed to was Denmark, which introduced the NIPT several years ago. Abortion rates for Down syndrome are approaching 99%. And so we're realistically looking at the prospect of some of these conditions disappearing in everyday society, but not because we've treated them or because we found a way to stop conceptions happening, but simply because we've given mothers and fathers the information that their child has Down syndrome at an early enough stage that almost all of them are choosing to abort.
Yes, that's right. And I think it's not surprising that many disabled people feel deeply, deeply concerned and hurt by this social activity, that the support there is for screening and abortion for fetal abnormality. And it's often seen as a kind of attack on them. And however much other people try to say, no, this is we're simply offering choices. We're not in any way wanting to lead to the eradication of Down syndrome. That's often how it is interpreted by people with disabilities.
Hmm. I remember seeing once, I think it was a tweet from someone commenting on a story about the NIPT, saying, you know, something along the lines of, you know, a cure for Down syndrome is a total cure is possible. And it just struck me as almost dystopian, kind of the way that the language of cure was used, because there is no cure for Down syndrome. We are as far away from that as we ever have been. What they really meant was, we can build a society in which there are no people with Down syndrome, because they will all have been aborted before birth.
Yes, and just to read out what one disabled activist called Marcia Saxton put, she said, the message at the heart of prenatal diagnosis is the greatest insult. Some of us are too flawed in our very DNA to exist. We are unworthy of being born. Fighting for this issue, for our right and worthiness to be born, is the fundamental challenge to disability oppression. It underpins our most basic claim to justice and equality.
Hmm. And how do you respond then to the kind of medical professionals who say, well, hold on, that's not on us, that's on the parents who choose to have abortions. We never compel anyone, it's always their choice. We're just giving more information, and what could possibly be wrong with providing parents with better information to make their informed own decisions independently?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because that argument really taps into one of the very fundamental trends in our whole society, which is choice and consumerism. And how can you possibly be against choice? How can you possibly say that offering choices to people is not a good thing? And I think we need to sort of stand back and say, but is that really right? And often as a paediatrician, it strikes me that after a baby is born, we come and we examine the baby, and then we say to the mother, now, this is a wonderful baby here. Is this the baby that you chose? I mean, are you really happy with this baby? Are you happy to take this baby home? You know, it's your choice. It's completely free. You know, suddenly the rhetoric of choice is lost. We don't talk about choices for parents. We talk about choices about, you know, what kind of education you want for your child, but we don't ask the parents whether they really want this child, or whether they're going to look after this child, whether this is the child they'd ordered. So the language of consumerism is very limited. It applies at one area in the human journey, but not in others. And then the question is, well, why not? Why do we offer choices at some part in the journey, but not another?
And that kind of has other wider ramifications for mothers in particular, who, because they're aware that these choices might be coming down the track for them, have a kind of implicit subconscious pressure to distance themselves from their unborn child, because there's a chance that they might have to choose an abortion if they're told by a doctor, you know, in 12, 20 weeks' time that this child has some horrendous genetic condition. And as you say, previously, pregnancy was all about anticipation, whereas now I know that you've pointed to studies before which talk about how women have this almost defense mechanism often, or they describe it as, where they don't want to get too attached. They certainly don't want to tell people too widely, just in case they have to have an abortion. And that's a choice or a judgment that previous generations of women never had to make.
Yes, so it's paradoxical that the very existence of this technology seems to be creating a kind of psychological distance between the mother and her unborn baby. I have to hold back from becoming too attached, quotes, to this being in my womb, because of the possibility that the test will show an abnormality, and then I'll have to, quotes, walk away. I'll have to say, sorry, thanks, but no thanks. And it's only after all the tests have shown my baby is healthy that I can then really bond with my baby and say, yes, this is the baby I want. This is the baby I'm going to love and care for. And so it to me, it's just very sad that this kind of psychological consequences of the technology has really transformed the experience of pregnancy. And one of the things I've noticed is that once these terrible fears, you know, because, you know, if you were a conscientious parent, you'd have to go and look up all these rare conditions and say, you know, what is this condition and why are they doing testing for it? And I didn't realize there was a 1 in 200 chance that my baby might have this. And so the pregnancy is spent worrying about, you know, what if the test was wrong? Maybe they missed it and maybe there is some terrible condition that my baby has got. So there's a very sort of medicalizing. The whole experience of bringing a child into the world has now become medicalized and is affected by technology and worries about rare medical conditions.
There's a real tragic paradox there, or an irony there, isn't it, in that with every passing year, mothers and fathers, but particularly mothers, are able to know more about their unborn child. And yet the more they know, the more they are implicitly kind of forced to distance themselves in case this terrible choice arises. Whereas previously, parents knew nothing about their child. It was a total black box what was going on inside of them. And that lack of knowledge allowed them to be intimate and close because there was no kind of implicit choice that had to be made about whether they would keep the child or not.
Yes, and this is a wider issue. It's not just for the prenatal testing. It also happens later on in life. Do I want to have testing which will tell me whether I've got a rare genetic condition when there's no treatment available? And when people are offered that possibility, and when it's known that there's a possibility that they carry a rare genetic condition, interestingly, many people decide, I don't want to have the test. Mm. I'd rather not know and live my life without knowing. So what it illustrates is how that knowledge is not an unmitigated good, that knowing things about my child, knowing things about myself, isn't always good. It can actually have unforeseen and very negative consequences.
And another strand to this that we haven't discussed yet is the fact that this knowledge is not perfect. And as we're talking about, it's always percentage chances. And even a 99% confirmation of X, Y, Z does not mean that, there are millions of children born every year in the UK alone, probably, maybe hundreds of thousands. But there's a lot, and so 1% chances happen quite a bit. And so that means there's plenty of time where women have gone for all the tests that they've been asked to take and have been told, you've got the all clear. And then they come 9 months down the line, they give birth, and the doctors say, I'm afraid your child does have X condition or Y abnormality. And they feel cheated, betrayed, astonished, because they had been effectively told that that was a risk that they had mitigated and managed by taking all these tests. And actually, obviously, you know, no test is perfect.
Yes, and so it's almost like there's a sort of an unspoken contract which is entered into. The pregnant woman agrees to have all these complex technological tests, to turn up for antenatal, to have testing, to have monitoring and scans and all the rest, and then the doctors, the technocrats, implicitly promise that it provided you do everything, we will give you a perfect baby. And then when the baby is born and it's apparent the baby does have some kind of condition that was missed, there's a sense of outrage that I kept my part of the bargain, but you, the technocrats, have failed. And of course, the reality is that the technology cannot promise that kind of 100% accurate prediction.
Hmm. So we're coming to the end of this episode, but we wanted to talk further on this about some of the Christian responses and the wider ethical issues about society as a whole, about prenatal testing. And in particular, this idea that is knowledge always a good thing, and what implications might this the ever onward march of prenatal testing mean for medicine and society as a whole. But just lastly then, just before we leave, I wanted to ping a difficult question to you. is the best thing therefore to do to just to refuse all prenatal testing and just go wind the clock back to 1960s before this was possible and just say, I'll take the child I'm given?
No. The short answer is, if there is testing that can really make a difference for my child, particularly before birth, then yes, I think, in general, the right thing to do is to have those tests to look for treatable conditions. But if the testing is entirely for genetic abnormalities for which no treatment is available, then I think choosing to refuse to have those tests is a perfectly valid and responsible option. And for what it's worth, Celia and I agreed that we would not have those, the tests for Down syndrome, because there was no point. We would love the child. We'd been given whatever their condition was. And so that is certainly a responsible option, which I would recommend for those who feel, as I do, that abortion for a disabling condition is inappropriate.
All of us have wondered what happens when we die. And I'm excited to say that N.T. Wright has written an amazing book called Surprised by Hope that provides a fresh perspective and incredible insight on this crucial subject. This powerful book is our gift to you today to say thank you for your financial support of Premier Insight this month. Dive deep into the biblical understanding of life after death and how it can transform your life today. Supplies are limited, so don't miss out. So go now to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Don't forget to request your copy of Surprised by Hope. Thanks for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
You mentioned in passing, John, last week that you didn't really think that knowledge was always automatically a good thing. Could you explain a bit more about why that is? Because I think that might strike people as a slightly odd thing to say, particularly as a scientist, you know, devoted to discovering more knowledge.
Yes, and I think this is an interesting thing because it's a distinction between a kind of a modern secular liberal perspective, which tends to see truth and knowledge as an unalloyed good, and a more nuanced position as a Christian, which sees in a fallen world, knowledge can actually be very damaging, and therefore there is both a place for confidentiality. I mean, it's a slight going off a slight tangent, but it is interesting that. It was the Hippocratic group of physicians back in the ancient world who were really the first to recognise that confidential medical information could, if that was released into the society as a whole, could be extremely damaging. And therefore, part of the Hippocratic oath was that I will treat all information that I become privy to because of my work as a physician as a most holy secret, and ever since then, medical confidentiality has been seen as an incredibly important way of protecting patients from harm. So there's a recognition right from there that some information cannot be just released into the public domain. That great harm can be done. And I think it's a similar kind of idea that understanding the future isn't an unalloyed good. I mean, just do a thought experiment. Suppose that by doing some kind of test or scan, I could predict with almost 100% accuracy when you were going to die and what you were going to die from. You know, would you like to have the result of that scan? And I think, when you put it like that, you start to think, well, what effect is that knowledge going to have on my life? You know, is that going to be a good thing? Is it going to help me to really live a full life and knowing how I'm going to die and when I'm going to die? And I think in a fallen world, knowledge about the future, which is often what genetics gives us, is a kind of an unhelpful thing. And it is fascinating to me that in the biblical narrative, predicting the future in any kind of specific way is actually seen as a negative thing. It's part of soothsaying. God's people are told not to go to magicians and necromancers who are going to tell you about the future. So there's a distinction between prophecy, which is seeing the broad outlines of God's plans and purposes for the future, versus this kind of soothsaying, which is seen as actually a negative and destructive kind of activity. And I just wonder whether predictive genetics, this ability to predict what the future holds by using genetics, it has an aspect of a modern version of soothsaying.
Hmm. I mean, it strikes me up the front, of course, you know, what was it that Adam and Eve were forbidden from doing? It was from eating the tree, which would give them the knowledge of good and evil. And so from the outset, God recognized that this knowledge which he possessed could be destructive to his creatures made in his image, his new human beings, and for their own good warned them, you don't want that knowledge, you're not supposed to have that knowledge, it's not good for you. But it also strikes me as well, I was, when you're listening to you, that there's often a phrase that's often banded around, is that knowledge is power. But actually in this question of screening and testing, a lot of this knowledge is really powerlessness. It's insight without the ability to change, as you say, that insight about the future without the ability to change the future can be quite toxic, really.
It's a form of determinism, isn't it? And to some extent, it's just false. I mean, the idea of genetic determinism, you know, this idea that my entire life and future, yeah, just depends on the precise nature of my genetic code. It's just rubbish. It's completely false, but it's an idea which is very potent. And of course, that's even true. You know, if you using prenatal testing discover that your unborn baby has Down syndrome, that doesn't tell you what their personality is going to be like, or mm-hmm. how they're going to respond, whether they'll be very musical, you know, how they live their life. Well, all these things are not determined by your chromosomes. But there is a kind of implication that once we've got the chromosomes, now we know what the future holds.
And I suppose there's also this kind of unwritten, assumed assumption that the doctors are simply imparting information and it's just value-free. It's just facts. It's just accurate scientific genetic information. And it's up to the parents to decide what to do with that. But of course, as we discussed last week, really parents aren't remotely equipped to do that, and I imagine a doctor spend a lot of the time saying the test shows your child as X, and the next question is not, thank you doctor, I will go and make my decision. The next question is, well, what do I do? And the doctor is desperately saying, well, that's not really for me to say, but the parent is saying, well, you can't just drop this knowledge bomb on me to say my child has an X percentage chance of having this condition I never heard of, and then just walk away. How is that good care?
Yeah, and this is very much part of how we understand a doctor-patient relationship. And historically, it was a very paternalistic relationship, a kind of father-child relationship. And you know, I'm the doctor, I'm the father, and you've got this little problem in the test, and don't you worry about it. We'll sort it all out for you, and we'll make the right decisions for you. No need to worry your little head about it, kind of thing. Which is obviously inappropriate in the modern world. But I think what is often replacing it is where the power is completely reversed the other way round, and it becomes a kind of client-technician relationship where I tell you, well, you've got this option, you know, you could have this test, you could have that test, you could have an operation, you know, we can give you the baby, we'll take the baby away if you want. You choose. It's your choice, it's your body, it's your life, it's your pregnancy. And then the problem is, of course, is that how can I make those choices? I don't know. You know, I'd need to go away and read every textbook before I could make any choice. So I think a better model, a third way, if you like, is an expert-expert relationship where I, the physician, am supposed to be the expert in terms of the diagnosis and the genetics and the possible implications and what other investigations are available. But you are the expert in terms of your life, your philosophy, your history, your family, the things that really matter to you. And the task is that for us to meet together as experts with mutual respect and to try to find a way forward of consensus. And I'm sharing my expertise. And that may include, you know, if you ask me, well, what would you do, doctor, in this situation? I'll say, well, if you really want to know, this is how I would face it. But in the end, it's going to be your choice. You have to make that decision.
And did that happen in your own practice? I mean, you must have had lots of agonizing conversations with parents who had been told something unexpected about their newborn child. And did they ever ask you, well, what would you do in my shoes? And did you avoid the question? Did you have to just say, do you know what, here's what I would do?
Yeah, I did. I wouldn't answer it immediately. I would push back slightly and say, you know, I think before I answer that question, I think you need to think some more about, you know, what really matters to you, what, you know, and you may think this, you may think that, and so on. But in the end, if it was clear that somebody really would want to say, well, I will tell you, this is if this was our situation, this is what we would do. And in the case of a child who was diagnosed with severe disabilities, I'd say we would carry on the pregnancy if this was our child, and we would try to make sure that the baby had every possible treatment and care after birth. And even if that meant that the baby was going to die within a few hours or days, we would still do everything we could possibly to care and love for our baby. But in the end, I would then say, that would be my choice, but the question is, what's your choice? That's the decision you have to make.
And I think that, from my perspective as a non-healthcare professional, someone who is, you know, a recipient of treatment rather than someone delivering it, that's actually what I want. I mean, that feels like in my lifetime, the NHS has been kind of gripped by this patient choice mantra, which has a lot of positives, but has really puts you in an awkward spot. I mean, I remember a few years ago going with someone to A&E on the advice of, you know, NHS 111 after we rang up, because they were having some unusual kind of heart and quality of symptoms. And after a long wait, we finally get shown to the doctor, and he kind of reads the notes and then turns and says, well, right, what would you like me to do? And there was this long pause, and I was like, well, I think we're here to find out.
That's what we're here for. That's what we've come for.
It was just totally bizarre, like punting the ball back to us. And I'm like, you spent 20 years honing your craft and understanding the body, so I don't need to know how to treat myself. I'm here to be treated by the expert. And not, as you say, not in a paternalistic kind of patronizing way, but you can swing. I wonder if we've overcorrected and gone too far the other way.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think the idea of the physician as a wise friend, you know, what you want is someone who you feel is on your side, and who is bringing wisdom and knowledge to the table, but is not going to dominate and coerce, but is going to be there, someone you can lean on, someone you can feel is committed to you and your best interests. And I think you're right. I think there was very definitely a phase in the NHS when the medicine was being compared to a service industry. You know, we're basically just providing a similar service to supermarkets or to any other customer facing service industry, and therefore, you know, the most important thing is that the customer is always right. You know, whatever you want, it's always there for you, and we want people to complain, because complaints are really important, because that's the way we improve our service. And you know, there was a phase when NHS management was filled with this kind of service industry approach. And of course, the whole point is that healthcare is not like a supermarket, and therefore, it's a very inappropriate model. However attractive it is in a certain sort of liberal free market economy.
Hmm.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And so coming back to the kind of thinking about prenatal screening as Christians, do you think, therefore, we touched on this briefly last episode, but do you think, therefore, a healthy way, if you're a Christian and you're personally convinced that it wouldn't be right to abort a child because they had a disability, that other than the kind of ultrasound and the other and things like that, that you can actually do something about, the healthiest, easiest option is to say, you know, when I'm offered the choice on my menu of services, to say no thank you to the NIPT and no thank you to X, Y, and Z other tests that may become available?
Yeah, I think there are two separate things there. One is there are some people who say, yeah, I hear the argument that this, you know, that every life is precious and it's special, but actually, you know, surely it is true that for some people born with disabilities and congenital abnormalities, that they do face terrible suffering. They face years of treatment and invasive, unpleasant experiences. And why is it wrong to, out of compassion, to say we should end that life? It's not saying anything about disability in general. It's simply saying that the compassionate thing to do, if you know that your child is going to have a life full of suffering, it is to have an abortion. So there certainly are Christians, including some of my good friends that I've talked privately about this, where they have said, and I know they have on occasion had abortions, but when a diagnosis of a serious fetal abnormality was made. So I think there are Christian arguments that are made in that direction. I think the other argument that is sometimes said is that I'm not planning to have an abortion, but I would like to prepare myself.
Yes.
And therefore, by having the test, I can prepare myself. I can go through the rest of the pregnancy planning and preparing for this baby who has special needs, and that is a valuable and important role.
I can see the thinking there, though I suppose it does. It's almost dangling the forbidden fruit in front of you, isn't it? It's giving if the test comes back positive for one of these conditions, even if you were at the outset said, do you know what, I don't believe in abortion for disability, and I just want to be prepared. When you have that knowledge, and then you have to sit day by day, week by week, and, you know, in the UK you can abort all the way up to term for disability, so there's no cutoff. I wonder whether the temptation, such, maybe that's the wrong word, hangs over you like that. It becomes a challenge, and balancing that stress over the ability to, as you say, prepare in advance is an interesting one. But I think what I struggle with, the initial argument, the kind of argument from compassion, as it were, that you know, why would we bring children into the world who we think are going to suffer from a terrible condition? It strikes me as relatively self-centered, because really the parent is saying, I imagine that my child, should they be born with a disability, would rather they were dead. But in truth, that they don't know that. And I'm pretty confident if you actually go and talk to people who are alive today with disabilities, none of them say, do you know what, I wish my mum or dad had aborted me before I was born.
Yes, and this is what is sometimes called the disability paradox, which has been repeatedly investigated and demonstrated. And that is that if you ask somebody who doesn't have a physical disability to imagine that they, for instance, were living life in a wheelchair, or that they were blind, or they had some other severe physical impairment or disability, and then to say, what do you think your quality of life would be? How do you think you would respond in that? Most people say, oh, it would be very negative. You know, it would be horrible. I mean, to imagine spending the whole of your life in a wheelchair, or spending the whole of your life with that problem, it would just be terrible. It would be horrific. My life would be horrific. But when you then interview people who are actually in that situation, and you say, can you describe what your life is? People with disabilities, including those with sometimes very severe disabilities, actually tend to give a very positive statement of the value of their life and say, actually, you know, yes, I have frustrations, but then who doesn't have frustrations? But actually, there are so many positive things about my life, and I really enjoy this, and I look forward to that. And I, most of the time, I'm not spending my time thinking, if only I didn't have this impairment. In fact, what many disabled people say, my real problem is not so much the disability itself. My real problem is social responses. Mm-hmm. It's other people's responses to my disability. It's how society responds to me. That's my real problem. That's what really causes me difficulty.
Yeah, this is the kind of social model of disability, isn't it? Which says that, you know, we see the person in the wheelchair and think, gosh, how awful their life must be. Their life is inevitably going to be terrible because they can't use their legs. But actually, if the world was full of ramps and lifts, they would, their lack of capacity in their legs would be less, or potentially even no big deal at all. And so that their disability is actually a product of society, not a product of their physiology, which I think can be overstated, but is certainly a powerful and compelling kind of way to flip the thinking of disability on its head. Think about it, as you say, from through the eyes of the disabled rather than from the kind of paternalistic, able-bodied people looking down on them.
Yes, and what's worse is that what is then suggested is that the medical profession are really implementing society's prejudices against disabled people, so that instead of changing society so that it's more accepting of disabled people and making sure that people with wheelchairs and with visual impairments and so on are being able to live their lives normally, instead of doing that, we're employing medical technology and medical specialists in order to try to eliminate people before birth who have these disabilities. So we're just implementing a kind of societal prejudice against disabled people. I mean, it's an extreme version of putting it, and certainly my experience of talking to parents who've been in this sort of appalling, agonising dilemma is none of that is relevant, really, or none of that tends to come out in the conversation. What comes out is much more this worry about suffering. And you're right that you could argue that this is all subjective and not based in reality. But I do know that for many parents, this is a very real and painful decision. And they often feel that they're left with an impossible decision. Now you've given me this information, doctor. I remember one woman saying to me very vehemently, she said, "You've put me in an impossible decision. Either I am responsible for bringing this child with severe problems into the world, or I am responsible for killing my baby." I mean, what kind of choice is that? Hmm. And you can see how the pain that lies behind that kind of decision. And that's really why I think there is an argument that better not to know and better not to have that decision forced on you.
I think what frustrates me in some of my more kind of cynical and intemperate moments is that I hear a lot of the language from people who have chosen, or who say they would, hypothetically, choose to have an abortion should they be given a kind of diagnosis of some kind of abnormality or genetic condition. And it's always phrased in the compassion, you know, it wouldn't be fair to bring this person who would suffer, you know, they wouldn't have a good life, and wouldn't it be better for everyone? And I just can't, I have this niggling doubt in the back of my mind that really, subconsciously, what they actually are is, I don't want to be the parent to a disabled child. I think that sounds like hell. And that is not something I signed up for when I wanted to have a baby. And so let's start from scratch and wipe the slate clean. But that it's a bit too brutal to be honest and say it out loud. And so they frame the argument around the needs of the child as an unconscious psychological defense against admitting to themselves that actually they're too afraid, or dare I say even potentially a little too selfish, to be the parent of a disabled child.
Well, I think there's a lot in what you say, except that it isn't going on at a conscious level.
No.
I think, in fact, there is very deep sort of suppressed emotions and feelings often in these kind of dilemmas. And I think this is revealed in the interesting evidence that shows that there is a significant incidence of distress and psychological problems, depression and so on, following abortion. But what's very interesting to me is that all the evidence shows that it's significantly higher, the risk of and the incidence of depression, psychological upset, and long-lasting psychological problems. It's higher when an abortion is being carried out for a fetal abnormality than when it's being carried out for a so-called social abortion. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because I think there were many people who might say, well, I think a social abortion for no reason, that's quite wrong. But an abortion for fetal abnormality, yes, I can understand why that would be the right decision. Mm. And yet it's those decisions that seem to have a greater incidence of psychiatric and psychological distress. And I think it reflects this exactly the kind of conflicting emotion. You know, am I genuinely, when I've decided to end the life of my child, am I genuinely acting in their best interests? Am I genuinely doing it for them? Or was I being selfish? Am I protecting myself? And is that what a mother should do, to put her own interests before those of her child? And after I've had the abortion, then I see a child with Down syndrome walking down the street with their parents, and I suddenly think, gosh, is that what my child would have looked like? And did I do the right thing? And that child looks very happy, and would my child have been happy? And so there's a very complex kind of mix there of deep psychological forces and emotion. And I know that counsellors like Celia, my wife, who've been involved in counselling women, often in these situations, often it takes weeks of sort of exploration and patient listening and sharing and sometimes crying together to really come to a place of understanding and reconciliation about some of these very, very painful decisions.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. Clearly, I mean, we always act with mixed motives, don't we? And who can honestly kind of, with any of the weighty decision of this nature, honestly go backwards and pick through, you know, what is genuine self-reflection and what was my real instigating factor here and what was just me kind of erecting psychological defences because I don't want to believe that I am the kind of person who would do X, Y, and Z. And that's the kind of thing that needs to be worked out in therapy over many, many weeks, months, years even, I suppose.
Yeah, I think one of the really interesting and positive things that's happening is the development of what is sometimes called disability theology of an understanding that instead of this entirely negative view, this view that human beings are meant to be perfect, and then to the degree to which we're all disabled, that is a kind of negative and almost subhuman way of existing, and historically sometimes that's been a kind of theological perspective. I know that in the distant past, the birth of a child with malformations was sometimes seen as a sort of portent, a sign from God of some judgment or some other. So it's very much this person with disabilities, this child was seen as an other, as a sort of strange, almost subhuman entity. There's been much more recently a very much more positive move to seeing that disabled people within the community sometimes seem to reflect something very precious and unique, far from it being a negative and subhuman existence. They're often people with disabilities, with learning difficulties, are bringing something into our society as a unique reflection, a revelation of God himself.
I think that's really true, and it's one of the things that's particularly acute. I know this example we keep using when you come back to Down syndrome, because I think at the same time, tragically, that the kind of abortion rates have been ticking up and fewer Down syndrome children are being born, actually those who are living with Down syndrome are having better and better outcomes. And you know, we used to think of Down syndrome as this kind of horrendous crippling disability, would put children in kind of homes and they would die in their teens or early 20s. And now I think life expectancy for someone with Down syndrome is in its 50s and is increasing all the time. And there is a rise of, people often refer to them as self-advocates. I think of a lovely Christian woman called Heidi Krauter, who's been doing quite a lot of activism in the UK around abortion rules on disability. And she's someone with Down syndrome who lives independently and is married and is a really, you know, I've seen interviews of her, as a really charming, engaging person, speaks very passionately and obviously very truthfully out of her own experience on this issue. And it's on one level, it's really wonderful to see, as you say, how people's thinking is shifting on disability, and that we are recognizing how much they contribute, how, what the richness to the family of God's people they bring. And at the same time, you know, we're aborting more and more of them before they have a chance to grow into these, to the self-advocates and these huge benefits to society that they could be.
That's absolutely right. I had the privilege of meeting Heidi Krauter just a few weeks ago. I acted as an expert witness in the case where she, there was a judicial review about the law on the abortion of Down syndrome and other fetuses with abnormality, and which she undertook. And I met her at a conference, and she, as you say, is absolutely remarkable lady, full of life and laughter, and certainly there's no doubt that an understanding that people who are different from us can actually bring a richness into the human community, and that our calling is to love and accept and respect them and learn from them as much as we can pass on to them as well. So I'm looking towards the future. I'm positive. I think, yes, there are some really challenging questions coming, and as genetic science advances, and particularly as this kind of free market in genetic testing is increasing, I think something we're going to come back to in future podcasts to look at what the implications are of the advancing genetic science and so on. But I do think the rise of disability theology, the much greater and positive awareness of how much we have to learn from people with disabilities, and the importance of Christian communities welcoming and accepting and being open towards people with disabilities. I think we've a lot to learn, and there does feel a sense we're making progress in this very important area.
Mm. And just lastly, then, it makes me wonder what difference it would make people's decisions if, you know, in every time they were sitting in a room and receiving the confirmation that their unborn child had Down syndrome, as well as speaking to a doctor, they were also able to speak to someone like Heidi, you know, with that sort, that's, you know, more knowledge, more facts, but telling a slightly different story to the one, perhaps the kind of medicalized testing story that we discussed earlier.
Well, exactly, and that's something that I and others have pushed for. And there is a slogan from the disability rights movement which says, nothing about us without us. And so you would say, well, prenatal screening is definitely about people with disabilities, and therefore they should be there and they should be involved. The interesting thing is that many medical professionals actually push back about that. And they feel, bizarrely, that it would be manipulative or coercive or insensitive to encourage people to meet adults and children with Down syndrome, or families looking after children with Down syndrome, if they are wrestling with this question about prenatal diagnosis. So it's because choice and freedom of choice is seen as the supreme good, and this sort of rather paternalistic view that we mustn't influence that choice in any coercive or unhelpful way.
So only some additional forms of knowledge are good, then. They're effectively conceding there, aren't they? The knowledge from the test is good, but the knowledge of lived experience from someone who's had Down syndrome would be too upsetting, too coercive.
Well, there is a curious mix of paternalism and liberalism in the medical profession, I'm afraid.
Something to dig into in future episodes, no doubt. But we've run out of time again. Thanks, John. It's been a really interesting and thought-provoking discussion. I hope you guys listening at home have enjoyed it as well. There's lots more on John's website, johnwhite.com, about some of these issues around prenatal screening, abortion, fetal abnormality. That was a large part of his kind of medical practice. And I also must point out the book which gives this podcast its very name, also called Matters of Life and Death, which is a great read. It has a whole chapter on prenatal screening, fetal screening, and the quest for the healthy baby, which is a lot more information and some interesting studies that kind of further elucidate these issues. So I recommend getting a copy of Matters of Life and Death, the book. If you can, there are links on John's website where you can buy that. But thanks for listening. As always, you can get in touch with us. Just email molad@premier.org.uk. But otherwise, we'll see you next week. Thank you.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Clarkson here to let you know it's the holidays at Wayfair, and I'm so excited to share how you can add a little extra magic to your celebrations this season. I love this time of year, y'all. It's always filled with friends and family around the dinner table, holiday traditions, and my favorite, cozy time spent at home. Hosting is such a big thing during the holidays, and Wayfair has the perfect pieces to make your holiday celebrations even more festive and totally your style. To get the holiday Christmas spirit going at my house, we love watching some fun classic Christmas movies, baking in the kitchen together, having some holiday music on. It just makes everything more magical. One thing I love about Wayfair is they have so many options, because each year we like to do something a little different. Look, everyone knows no matter how much preparation you go in for Christmas time, it's so busy. So the free, easy delivery that Wayfair provides is something I really love. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to get your home holiday ready.
Wayfair, every style, every home.